Today we're going to look at verses 19 through 24 of John chapter 7. John chapter 7, verses 19 through 24. Jesus said, "Did not Moses give you the law? And yet none of you carries out the law? Why do you seek to kill me?" The crowd answered, "You have a demon. Who seeks to kill you?" Jesus answered them, "I did one deed, and you all marvel. For this reason, Moses has given you circumcision, not because it is from Moses, but from the fathers. And on the Sabbath, you circumcise a man. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, so that the law of Moses will not be broken, are you angry with me because I made an entire man well on the Sabbath? Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment." There is a story behind this story, and it comes from John chapter 5. So as you may recall, since we've already looked at John 5, Jesus was passing by the pool of Bethesda and saw a man who had been ill for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been a long time in that condition, he said to the man, "Do you wish to get well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. But while I am coming, another steps down in the water before me." Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your pallet and walk." Immediately the man became well, picked up his pallet and began to walk. And that's from John 5, 6 through 9. However, it was the Sabbath. And so we read in John 5, 16, because it was the Sabbath, the Jews were persecuting Jesus, since he was doing these things, healing on the Sabbath, and also recommending to this man that he carry his pallet on the Sabbath. They were persecuting Jesus. But their efforts to punish Jesus went beyond persecution, because we also read in John chapter 5, and this time verse 18, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because he not only was breaking the Sabbath, but also was calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. So it is this story from John chapter 5 that clarifies what Jesus is talking about when he says to the Jews that they want to kill him. Let's pray. Father, I do ask that you would use this part of the story to speak to us, to show us yourself and your ways. Speak to us about our mere human ways, and to lead us in the way everlasting. I pray this in Christ's name. Amen. I want to talk about three different things today, and the first one is judging according to a double standard, one for ourselves and one for others. In verse 19, Jesus says to these Jews, this crowd of Jews, "Did not Moses give you the law, and yet none of you carries out the law? Why do you seek to kill me as if I am the only one breaking the law?" See, the Jews claimed Abraham as their founding father, but they looked to Moses as their spiritual father. They held the law of Moses in high esteem, and some Jews, like the Pharisees, were, and I say this respectfully, excessively diligent in studying and carrying out the minutest details and applications of the law. And yet, as we know from other parts of the four Gospels, they were breaking the law in a number of ways. For example, Jesus said in Matthew 23, verse 23, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. But these are the things you should have done without neglecting the others." So they were hypocritical in keeping the law. They kept the law on one hand, broke the law on the other hand. And in this situation with Jesus, they had taken their law-breaking even further in that they were looking for the opportunity to kill Jesus, as it states in John chapter 7, verse 1. The point here is that these Jews were hypocrites. And I want to give you three ways in which they were hypocritical. First, they claimed to keep the law and were teaching others to keep the law, while they themselves fulfilled only parts of the law and willfully broke or carelessly neglected other parts of the law. Second, they were ready to put Jesus to death for breaking their religious addendums to the Sabbath laws. He hadn't really broken the Sabbath law directly. He broke their addendums to the Sabbath laws. And yet, they themselves were willing to break the Mosaic law specifically and directly, for the Mosaic law said, "You shall not commit murder." Third, to murder someone was to do a great evil in God's sight. To shed men's blood, this was a great offense to God because life is in the blood. And the punishment for murder was the loss of your own life. On the other hand, to heal a person, even on the Sabbath, and specifically someone who had endured his sickness for 38 years, could hardly be counted an evil act. In fact, most would consider it a good deed. Yet the Jews were treating the evil they intended to do, which was murder, as if it were a great good, while treating the good Jesus did as if it were a great evil worthy of death. And those are the three ways that I want to point out that they were hypocritical about keeping the law. Like the Jews of Jesus' day, we are prone to hold one standard for ourselves and another standard for others. And as is most often the case, the standard we hold for ourselves is tolerant of failure and merciful. It has a lot of room for self-justifying explanations or defenses, and it is quick to forgive. In contrast, the standard we hold for others tends to be intolerant and exacting, easily angered over repeated failures. It is disinterested in explanations. It doesn't want to hear you explain away what you did. It's quick to condemn, slow to forgive. In other words, we hate the sin of others while too often only admitting that ours is wrong. That's about as far as we go with our sin, while hating the sin of others. It is my experience that among those who call themselves Christians, it is rare to find someone who hates his own sin as much as he hates the sin of those who treat him selfishly or unjustly, or who exasperate him or hurt him or in some other way mistreats him. It is just as rare to find a follower of Jesus who identifies, acknowledges, and honestly talks about his own sin as clearly and specifically as he talks about the sin of others. But it is rarer still to find someone who, with genuine humility and sorrow, weeps when he considers how poorly he has treated God by committing a particular sin in light of how good God has treated him in spite of his sin. It is too easy for us to have double standards. How often have you said about someone else, and especially about someone in your own household, "How could he?" Or, "What is she thinking?" Or, "How can he be so unreasonable?" Or, "How can she not see what she is doing and that it's totally wrong?" I know those phrases because I've used them. I've thought them. And how often do you say these same things to yourself when you do what is wrong and unloving or selfish or unkind or mean or hurtful? How could I? What was I thinking? And to take this a step further, how do you feel when the one who is upset with you and is criticizing or condemning you holds you to a higher standard than he holds himself? What does that make you feel like? And yet we are prone to do that to others. Like the Jews of Jesus' day, we are prone to hold one standard for ourselves and another standard for others. And yet, this kind of thinking and behaving ought never to be found among those who call themselves Christ ones. This ought never to be our way. Paul writes in Romans chapter 12, verse 9, "Let love be without hypocrisy." In relation to holding a double standard, we might say these same words this way: love others according to the same standard by which you want or expect to be loved. Love others by the same standard by which you want or expect to be loved. Then Paul goes on to say, abhor what is evil. Now, if we are to keep love free of hypocrisy, we must abhor evil in ourselves as much, if not more, than we abhor evil in others. To abhor evil in ourselves less puts us back into the double standard category and hypocrisy. And we must be humble and honest about our own selfish, hurtful, unkind, and unloving ways, just like we want to be honest about other people's. We tell them straight out. We need to tell ourselves straight out as well. And we must seek forgiveness. Ask for forgiveness. Make amends. Change our ways. And of course, we can do all this by the power and grace of God. He enables us. In relation to this, a number of years ago, being tied in with Christian Conciliation Services, someone produced a page with three columns. It was about asking for forgiveness. And there's three kinds of asking. In the one kind, you're groveling. In the next kind, you're explaining things away. And in the third kind, you are just straight out admitting you did what was wrong and you have no excuse. To see that on a piece of paper and read that through had a very powerful effect on me. I definitely knew how easy it was to explain away. You know I did what was wrong, but, and then you'd go on and explain why it wasn't so bad or why the other person shouldn't be so upset or something to that effect. And it became a real challenge in my life to actually say what I did wrong, admit I had no excuse, make no explanation, and just accept the consequences. Apart from that, we're back to holding a double standard. And so I want to encourage you, as well as myself, to live by a single standard, to live by God's standard, to live by love's standard. Show your gratitude for God's patience, mercy, and grace toward you, by treating others in the same way God treats you. Be humble yet honest with people. Be merciful yet truthful about how the sins of others damages the relationship you have with them. But like God, always love. Always long for meaningful relationship, even when the other person is driving you away with hurtful, selfish, sinful behavior. Or in the words of Jesus, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. Luke 6:27-28. For it is in this way that we overcome evil with good, rather than being overcome by evil. Romans 12:21. Let us, as followers of Jesus Christ, rise to that level of godliness whereby we live by the same standard we expect of others. Second thing I want to talk about today is the foolishness of denying guilt when we are guilty. John 7:20. The crowd answered, "You have a demon. Who seeks to kill you?" Now this crowd of Jews was either living in denial or unwilling to admit they were doing or at least intending to do something wrong. The plans were already in the works. This was known, that they wanted to kill Jesus. And the point here is that it is all too common for us to deny doing anything wrong. And in our denial, redirect the accusation of wrongdoing away from ourselves to the one who is accusing us. Who hasn't been accused and said, "But you do the same thing"? In this situation, Jesus accused them of wanting to kill him. But instead of admitting their guilt, they acted shocked. "How could you accuse us of such a thing?" was their response. And they acted offended that Jesus would accuse them. And what they did was they made him out to be the bad person for accusing them of wrongdoing. They redirected the accusations. Now, this is one of the oldest tricks in the world. This didn't start with you or with your kids or with your neighbor or with your boss or with your coworker. This is one of the oldest tricks in the world. Since the beginning, denying guilt and shifting blame so someone else looks like the bad person instead of you has been going on. Adam used this trick, and that's why I say it's the oldest trick in the world. Adam used this trick when God spoke to him about eating the fruit of the forbidden tree. After committing the sin, Adam realized he was naked, and he became afraid. So he hid himself from God. And when God asked Adam if he had eaten from the forbidden tree, Adam said, "The woman you gave me." Yeah, God, it's really your fault, because the woman you gave me, she gave me from the tree and I ate. In other words, Adam redirected the accusation, the condemnation, the blame away from himself to God and his wife. They were the ones who were responsible for his eating the fruit, not he himself. And here in John 7:20, the crowd infers their innocence, even though they weren't. And they inferred their innocence by acting as if Jesus was the guilty party for falsely accusing them. So once again, who of us hasn't done this? And yet, and this is what boggles my mind as I've thought about it over the years, are you aware that when you infer innocence, when you're guilty, And when you do this by accusing your accuser of doing something wrong, that you make yourself look worse. You make yourself look worse than you would have looked had you simply admitted your guilt and accepted your consequences. What are you trying to do? Make yourself look better. But in the eyes of your accuser, you are only, absolutely only, making yourself look worse. Okay, so you may be wondering how this makes you look worse. Let me give you three ways. First, you already look bad for having done something wrong. So that's established. Second, you increase how bad you look by denying you did anything wrong when the person who is accusing you knows you did. So you make yourself look even worse by denying you did anything wrong or by trying to explain it away. And third, you show just how dishonest or irrational you are willing to be in order to be seen as innocent when you aren't. You look worse. Now the reality is we can be just as foolish and irrational as Adam and as the Jews of Jesus' day when it comes to denying guilt and making our accuser appear to be the bad person. But once again, we are Christ ones. We have been bought and paid for. We have been transformed. So as children of God, let us, you, me, let us accept the blame we deserve. Let us admit our guilt. Seek forgiveness. Make things right. Correct our ways. And get back up to doing what we know is right. There is more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 who need no repentance. The third thing I want to talk about today is the justice of judging righteously. I'm going to read verses 21 to 23 from the Living Translation, the New Living Translation. And I'm going to do this because it provides an element of clarity that we don't find in the New American Standard. So it's rare that I part with the New American Standard. I know it's my Bible. I'll admit that. But today, for added clarity, I want to read from the New Living Translation. Verse 21, Jesus replied, I did one miracle on the Sabbath, and you were amazed. Well, not amazed like we often think, you know, like really impressed. They were amazed that he did work on the Sabbath. Because a good Jew wouldn't work on the Sabbath. Then Jesus went on to say, but you work on the Sabbath also. When you obey Moses' law of circumcision. And then we have this little parenthetical statement where Jesus says, actually, this tradition of circumcision began with the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, long before the law of Moses. So the law of circumcision was established long before the law of Moses was given. And then verse 23, Jesus says, for if the correct time for circumcising your son falls on the Sabbath, you go ahead and do it so as not to break the law of Moses. So why should you be angry with me for healing a man on the Sabbath? In other words, you'll do what is right on the Sabbath even if it breaks the law of Moses. So why would you be mad at me for doing something good on the Sabbath? In these three verses, Jesus is using reason. He's reasoning with these Jews in an effort to get his audience to understand and accept the point about judging which he states in verse 24. But before getting to verse 24, I want to point out two realities about using reason in an effort to get people to be reasonable. So these are two realities about using reason in an effort to get people to be reasonable. First, some people in certain areas of life refuse to be reasonable. The unreasonable thing or wrong that they are doing is so rewarding that they refuse to let reason get in the way of doing it. What this means is that trying to reason with them about what they are doing is useless. You can't reason an unreasonable person into reason when they are committed to their unreasonableness. Second, everyone, including those who refuse to be reasonable in certain areas of life, everyone believes we all ought to be reasonable. Everyone believes we all ought to behave in a reasonable way. Everyone believes we are all capable of being reasoned with. I'm suggesting these are universal truths. And this is why even those who remain unreasonable in one or more areas of life use reason in their effort to get you or to get others to stop doing what they believe is unreasonable or wrong and start doing what is sensible and right. I know this is a dichotomy. I know this doesn't make sense, but this is the way people are. Now, a word of caution about dealing with those who refuse to let reason stop them from doing what is unreasonable or wrong. Dealing with such a person is exceedingly frustrating. And I mean the word exceedingly. Therefore, do not allow frustration or exasperation or despair to open the door to dealing with such people in an ungodly way. Fight and resist the urge to use ungodly anger, unkind words, or verbal and physical abuse. It may make you feel better momentarily, but it won't get the job done. And it just makes you ungodly. To become just as ungodly or unloving or uncaring or unkind as the person who refuses to be reasoned with moves us outside of God's will, God's protection, and there is no advantage to that. I know from experience, personal experience, that dealing with an unreasonable person is exceedingly challenging. But I also know how tempting it is to resort to ungodly means to try and get through to the unreasonable person. It is exceedingly tempting. I often thought about it as I just want to pick up a ball bat and hit the person in the head to get their attention. But let me remind you that by God's gracious empowerment, by trusting God to be your first and foremost source of security, and by choosing to love regardless of how you are treated, you can remain godly in the face of such a challenge. And so I encourage you to do so. Verse 24, this is where Jesus was heading with this whole reasoning approach. Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. What is the difference between judging according to appearance and judging with righteous judgment? To judge according to appearance is to take your first observations, or the word of a single witness, or those parts of the situation that fit your preconceived idea of what happened, or to look only for those facts that support your purpose for judging in the first place. Let me say that once more. To judge according to appearance is to take your first observations, or the word of a single witness, or those parts of the situation that fit your preconceived idea of what happened, or to look only for those facts that support your purpose for judging in the first place and making a decision. To illustrate the hypocritical form of justice these Jews were pursuing, let me read you this short story from Luke chapter 14, verses 1 through 5. Luke 14, 1 through 5, here's the story. And it came about when Jesus went into the house of one of the leaders of the Pharisees on the Sabbath to eat bread, that they, that is the religious leaders, were watching him closely. Now, they weren't watching him closely to see what he was wearing or how he did his hair or how he was going to eat, but to see if he would do something wrong. And there, in front of him, was a certain man suffering from dropsy. Dropsy is the swelling that happens in our body under our skin from excessive fluids accumulating there. So he swell up. Jesus spoke to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" Well, Jesus spoke to the lawyers. They're the first ones mentioned, so of course they didn't answer. They would never incriminate themselves. They know better. So they kept silent. And Jesus took hold of the sick man and healed him and sent him away. And then Jesus said to the group that was there, "Which one of you shall have a son or an ox fall into a well and will not immediately pull him out even on a Sabbath day?" "You'll work on a Sabbath day. Why can't I?" "You do good on a Sabbath day. Why can't I?" These lawyers and Pharisees, they thought it unreasonable to break the Sabbath law to rescue or preserve something of value in a human being who was sick. It was wrong for Jesus to heal this man, but it was not wrong for them to rescue their own child or one of their farm animals. Like these Jews, we can have ungodly, unjust and self-serving motives in judging someone. You see, they weren't judging Jesus for breaking the Sabbath simply because he broke the Sabbath. They were looking for something to condemn him on. They had ulterior motives. And when this is true, the reality is we're not seeking justice. Instead, we just want to condemn. We just want to strike back. We just want to make the other person look bad. Or maybe, like them, we're seeking to protect what we have or get something we want. Jesus was a threat to their position and their power as religious leaders. Unjust justice is selfishness. To judge with righteous judgment is to seek the truth in order to judge with fairness. This requires studying the situation, asking more questions, seeking additional witnesses, considering the intent of the law in relation to the wrong that's being done. Taking into account the way the law has been applied in the past. And looking at the larger picture surrounding the incident or the person that's being judged. If you want to judge righteously, begin by examining your motives for judging the person or situation you are judging. What is your true intent? What is it you're after? What is it you want to come from this? Next, pursue the truth. Don't pursue what you need to know in order to condemn the person. Pursue the truth wherever it leads you. Consider the intent of the rule. Why was the rule made? What's the purpose of it? Consider what the social practice is in that situation. Consider the standard of love. How is it to be applied in that situation? And see the larger picture, not just the incident in question. Too often, we are so involved in the immediate incident that we don't think about where we want to wind up an hour later, a day later, a week later, a year later, 10 years later. And many times, it's that way because we're so frustrated or tired of going through the same wrong over and over again that we just want to end it now. See the larger picture. Where are we going with our judgment? What's the purpose of what we're doing in judging? Where do we want to get to? What do we hope will be the outcome? The outcome may take 10, 20, 30 years. If I want it to end right now, I need to take that person's life. But if I want the outcome that I hope for, I may have to be patient. Doesn't mean I don't tell the truth. It doesn't mean I don't deal with the issues. But it means I'm headed someplace and I deal with it accordingly. See the big picture, not just the incident in question. Speak the truth, but speak it with love and respect. In applying consequences, remain merciful. In dealing with a specific situation, remember, it's likely to happen again. It's unlikely that we are simply stopping something. We are working at changing someone, asking them to be different, and that's a process. And so the point that Jesus is making here in this last statement, John 7:24, is do not judge according to appearance. Guard against ulterior motives. Guard against lazy judging. But judge with righteous judgment. As followers of Jesus Christ, from this story today, we are reminded to hold ourselves to the same standard we hold others. When guilty, we're reminded to admit our guilt, make things right, and proceed to living according to godly love and God's righteousness. And when judging others, to judge with righteous judgment. And what I recommend is that we do this for the glory of God, for the health of the church, for the love of our fellow man, and for the well-being of our own souls.